I'm turning again this morning to the Song of Solomon and these chapters that we read. Thus far, the Song of Solomon tells the story of a young couple who love each other. And first of all, they are separated with a longing to be together again. In other words, they have known one another, they have come to love one another, but there were those things that were keeping them apart for a time. And eventually, within the first two chapters, they do find each other, and then they speak with great joy in one another's company and in mutual appreciation. I have outlined already, and we don't have time this morning for me to go through it all again, but I've outlined already how I understand that this is a book that is meant to highlight the love of a man and a woman for each other. That it is a good thing. It's a thing that God has made, and he has made it to be enjoyed and for the benefit of these two who become one in marriage. It's a book that provides us with wisdom for relationships, as we call them today, all the way through to marriage and how that's to be lived. But as well as that, I have pointed out how Paul, in writing to the Ephesians, he uses this human marriage relationship in its ideal to describe and to help us to see more clearly that the pure intimacy of the bond between Christ and his church, his people through faith and the Spirit. And thus, as we read on, while we need to recognize what it says about a marriage relationship, all that leads up to it and beyond, while we need to recognize that, we need to also recognize the light that this song casts on the vertical relationship, as we might call it, between us and God. So today, reading this further section of the song, here I must first point you to see those truths for that horizontal marriage, man and woman. My fear is that all too often, in our part of the church perhaps, we tend to think that these things are not such elevated matters and therefore shouldn't come so high on the list of themes and topics to be preached on Sunday. But I take time on this, and I do so praying that if there's any trace of that kind of thinking in your mind, it'll be banished. It will no longer remain. That's not valid. Because first of all, it's in our daily lives that we demonstrate whether there is faith in our hearts, whether the grace of God has touched us there. And second, closely linked to that, you talk about daily life, and how many of us, most of us, throughout the world, the whole human race, are affected by marriage in one way or another. We are either married ourselves or soon to be married, once were married, have friends who are married, are children of a marriage. Marriage runs through society as a whole, and it must be taken account of. And indeed, as I've mentioned previously, it is a thing that was made by God. It is a good thing. But if it's made by God, how does God mean it to be used? How does God mean it to be lived? Ought we not to think about these things? And in addition to that, it remains one of the main and most effective, incisive ways in which God has chosen to reveal his love for us through his Son, Christ Jesus. He uses all the language of marriage through the prophets and as I mentioned in Paul, for example. And so I've talked about that at greater length before. I need to pass on to today's passage, but I just want to remind you of these these key things and how valuable this is. So this, first of all, this morning, in this passage, I need to draw your attention chiefly to the human aspect of it. But at the same time, just to give some pointers as to where we might see light and illumination on that relationship between Christ and his church, on our Godward living. But I do hope to come back to that and expand on that very soon on another occasion. And the three parts that we have in these two chapters. The first part is from chapter 3, verses 1 through to 5, and I've described this as lost and found again. Then from chapter 3, verse 6 to the end of that chapter, verse 11, is the king's wedding. And then it's not absolutely descriptive of all that's contained in chapter 4, but most of it I'm putting under the heading of the beauty of the bride. Lost and found again. The king's wedding and the beauty of the bride. Those headings don't sound the same, they don't have the same letter, but they're there for you to see as you open that passage yourself. You'll see them just descriptive of what's there. Lost and found again. Now it appears, as chapter 3 opens, that this could well have been a dream experienced by the young woman. By night on my bed, I sought the one I love. By night, in fact, reflects the way it's put originally, it reflects that it was a repeated, it was an ongoing thing. It's kind of hinted at in our English there as well. It might be indicated better throughout the night or night by night. By night. Nights. During the nights. On a repeated basis. An ongoing search. I'm sure you've had dreams somewhere along the way in your life that have come back to you on several occasions, good or bad. And this seems, in those couple of words, it seems to be described as a recurring dream. As well as that, the reason I say it's a dream is because when you come to the second part of the chapter, you read of, then comes the king to his wedding. He's in his procession. In the second part, what comes after this? And in order to do that, in order to come in this procession, he has to go away, doesn't he, to prepare for it. And so perhaps there was, in fact, not just in a dream, but in fact, they had come together, and then he says, I need to go away and make preparations. There was another separation, however long that might be. And in the circumstances, seeing where she has come from, it wouldn't be surprising if it might have provoked something of a subconscious anxiety. She had lost him before. And it would almost appear that initially, that loss was not quite what they had planned either. Would it happen again? And so it is in this dream. She sets out to look for him again. I also say it's a dream because within these few verses, verses 1 to 4 especially, you have the whole process being fulfilled right through to marriage. That is suggested in the middle of verse 4, where she speaks of having brought him to the house of my mother. It speaks of that stage of enveloping him into her own family, that he's bound to her in that way. That house of my mother is also repeated later on in the book, in the song. It seems to convey her sense of security, that that's where she wants to bring him, because that would be everything all now in place. But if that is reflected in these few verses that she describes there, having found him, bringing him into her mother's house, if that reflects the marriage, then the marriage hasn't actually happened yet. This is all within her dream. And so that anxiety that she begins with, that he's away and she needs him, she wants to get hold of him again. Then she finds him, having searched for him. And then they are brought together in a way that they will no longer be separated. That is all wrapped up in this dream that she seems to be having a number of times. The actual story hasn't quite got that far just yet. She's troubled by the fear that this loved one has left her. It occupies her mind even through the night time. Even subconsciously. And it's on this then, first of all, that I want to just place a little weight. What this says, or should say to us, this is preoccupying her. I'm not an expert on dreams by any means, nor are you probably. But it doesn't take an awful lot to think that if you come out of a dream and you've seen familiar faces or you've been dealing with something in that dream, it's most likely something that has been of some concern to you or some interest to you. It's something that is looming quite large in your thinking. And I would suggest that that's what this is about. It speaks of how important he is to her. The fact that he does seem to have had to go away to prepare for this great occasion that is to come. But that's disturbing her. It's leaving her with some anxiety, and that is coming out during the night. It says this relationship is vitally important to her. It is a big thing in her life. Now, I'm not suggesting that you should become anxious if you don't dream of your wife or your husband or fiancé or whoever, someone important. You might not be an anxious type of person. You might be desperately tired. You sleep deeply and nothing troubles you. It's not that. Not that that's essential. But it's simply, as it happens in her experience, it simply highlights that he is important. That's a very simple thing to say. But it is so important to say it. I've already pointed at that as we looked earlier at chapters 1 and 2. He is just so significant to her. All her thinking is, if you like, almost obsessed with him. And that shouldn't be a surprise to us, though. At the level either of human marriage or of the relationship between Christ and his people. In terms of marriage, marriage is an exclusive matter. It's a thing that brings man and woman intimately together. That you two put together are vitally important to each other. Think of what Paul has to say. Where does he say it? Ephesians chapter 5. He says, so husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. Listen, he who loves his wife loves himself. But that's not all, he said, for no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as the Lord does the church. Your wife or your husband becomes as important as your husband or your wife, as you yourself are. But you can't escape the presence and the importance of your spouse in your life. And that's all I really want to draw out of that. There are details in there, but you can see the progression of what she's dealing with. One or two things that we may be able to come back to when we look at the Christ and the church again. But I think that's what it says to us, is that she's going through that experience which is so true to life, that what is big in her life that time is what appears in her dream. the concern she has for it, and the ultimate pleasure that she has when she finds him again. As for marriage, at the human level, how important is your spouse to you? You might think that's an unnecessary question, but it's not. We are frail, sinful human beings. We're in a world where husband and wife seem to be so insignificant at times. I remember a very good friend saying once that as their children, two children, got to almost to the point of, as you might call it, leaving the nest, they suddenly realized they had got to hardly know one another, husband and wife, because their lives had been taken up with their children rather than themselves. But this is saying to us, you can't let that happen. Marriage is the first step. Marriage is the first place. Other things that need to be based on that. Let's try and hear what he has to say about it for us. But let's also consider, just very quickly, just let me give you some pointers concerning what that means for us regarding Christ Jesus. I want to just trigger your thinking, at least, on applying it in that way. I remind you, first of all, that the relationship that this pictures is between Christ and his church, not just directly between Christ and the individual, but yet the church can function properly as it should be, as it's being described here, unless each member is engaged in this, with this mindset and in this relationship. Let me ask you concerning Jesus Christ. Does he fill your waking moments? Does he fill those times at night when you're lying awake? Doesn't need to necessarily be thinking simply, Jesus, 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 and so on. But it's a good time to think on what he has done for you. But it could equally be those matters that do otherwise leave you anxious. Someone in the family with a problem. Money troubles. What lies ahead for the future? It could be those ambitions that you have and the next major expenditure. Question is, how do you go about thinking these through? Those things that come to you when you are awake, those things that do turn your mind over in your dreams. How do you respond to them? Is it he? Is it his word that is your answer to all of them? You sang with me this morning, Psalm 63 and verse 6. When I remember you on my bed, I meditate on you in the night watches. As you go through times like that, as you go through the day, it doesn't just have to be a dream at night. Maybe not many of you have time to sit and daydream. I suggest you find time. It would be a worthwhile exercise, but if you do, what do you do with those daydreams? How do you go through your thinking when you're driving, concentrating on the road, but other things are going through your mind as well? How do you answer those things that crop up so quickly? They're the things at the forefront of your mind. They're the things that your subconscious is trying to deal with. They've become important to you. How do you answer them? Is it to ask yourself, what would please my Lord and Savior? What do I really need to do to sort out my way of life? Which direction would Jesus lead me? There's always that must bring you back to his word. You can't answer those questions unless you know his will. And that's where you'll find it, in the scriptures, in the Bible. That relationship, that loved one, was so desperately important to this young woman. And she dreamt of him. But as if that wasn't enough, we now return to real events in chapter 6 and verse 3, we come to the king's wedding. Some have suggested that this might also be part of a dream, but that's not terribly clear at all from the text. We don't need to go there. It really does seem as though now at last, in chapter 3, we find out who her beloved was. He was there earlier as a shepherd. Now we find the king, Solomon, who was to become the greatest of kings. Even if it was a part of a dream, I think it's striking that she sees him as a king. He's the king. She's marrying the king. Put yourself in her place. I'm marrying the king. You start to see immediately where that leads us regarding Christ as well. There's no doubt he was the king. But what do we see? As I described to the children, all eyes are on him. He's coming in his palanquin, as it's called, further down. He's coming, not in this fine car with a ribbon on it. It's not her in a fine dress, but it's him, the great king. And all eyes are set on him, not on her. He has a guard of honor. He has the best of materials and fragrances around him. The palanquin is a word that's used. It seems it's not always easy to know exactly what those words mean. They're not used very often in the Old Testament. But it's most likely like we might have seen a picture of a sedan car, but something very elaborate. It's something that was being carried. Possibly it had a couple of wheels on it. We just don't know. But he was being carried and brought into the city in great glory. See the things that it describes, the way that it was made. Even the wood of Lebanon. Pillars of silver, support of gold, seat of purple. Its interior paved with love by the daughters of Jerusalem. This is who it is. Her groom is coming to the wedding. It's a celebratory procession. Yes, it talks about the valiant men, valiant of Israel, holding swords, being expert at war. Have you seen the transformation? There was a program not so long ago about the horse guards up there in London. And at times they would be on sentry duty outside a palace in their finest of clothes, the red jackets and their breastplates and their helmets, and you could hardly see their face, and a bright shining sword. These very same people, the next thing you see, they're out there in a tank with camouflage uniform and everything. They're expert at war, but they're there to defend the queen, to be a guard of honor in all their finery and splendor. It's just what you have here. That's what they're doing. But with all that finery, I think the key to it is still what the king has to say. So he doesn't say it as such, but it must have come from him. This is how we know about it. It's on the day of his wedding, the day of the gladness of his heart. Yes, as the king, he goes through with all the finery. It is his wedding. This is a special event. But as far as he's concerned, what makes it special is that he's marrying the one he loves. It brings great gladness to his heart. To apply this, consider the joy of marriage. Some of us have been married for some time. Let's be honest now. Is it a thing that you just sometimes seem to get used to? I want to remind you from this of the great joy of marriage. And I think that must go far beyond just the way that things are done. We've heard about the lovely food, we've heard about the beautiful cake, we've heard about the fine dress. And yes, he's dressed in black, but he goes to some effort to do it, the groom. All that's involved to make a wedding just right in our culture. But is the reality behind it? It was in his case. It didn't obscure the gladness of his heart. We need to be sure that we don't allow the conventions of our age and our society, doing the right things, we don't allow that to undermine or to obscure the astonishing reality of a marriage between a man and a woman. It's a remarkable thing that, as the Bible says repeatedly from the very beginning, that a man and a woman, they too shall become one flesh. Every one of you is unique, brought together in a unique way in marriage. I can faintly remember being petrified on my wedding day. I don't know if my wife knows this, but I was petrified that I would forget something that had to be done. Otherwise, I think I went around with a bit of a grin, but apart from that, you see, there's a great confusion. Was it just pure joy and delight? Some of it was there. It was a wonderful thing for me. And I pray that it, trust him, that it was for each of you as you got married on that day. But we need to take it further. It's a case of pressing on and saying, let's recognize what really is here. It can be very easy for folk to not to see their own uniqueness in that particular event. There are so many who do get married in name, but they will never be precisely those two or you two becoming one. It's so magnificent, so special. Yet we see evidence all around us that society has forgotten that, because it's so easy to drop it along the wayside. Isn't this a suitable thing to preach about on Sunday? Marriage is a thing that goes throughout society, every society, every culture. We cannot just let marriages fail. And I'm not just talking about yours. I'll come back to that in a second. But everybody's around us. How do we view it? Do we recognize it for what it really is? We cannot let it go by without reestablishing God's way, which is to my mind, is brought out here in a renewed sense of glory and joy, the gladness of his heart. And as for ourselves, be renewed in it yourself, in a marriage. Be strengthened in it. Rejoice in it. It's unique. It's something that God has given you out of his great grace. Don't just become used to it. But remember this. Let it ring in your minds. Let this be the thing that is in your dreams. The gladness of his heart. The gladness of her heart. And thus also, as I have given a pointer previously about Christ and his church, we take this too. Think of what it means regarding Christ and his church. Look at what he brings into the marriage. Just as they did there, everyone was looking to him. Here, everyone looked to him. It's not about me. It's about giving him honor. And then the remarkable thing is that he turns around, and by the honor he receives and he takes his bride, he gives honor to her as well. Bride herself looks on at his glory too. She sets him out and she tells us of him as the king. He's the one who's worthy of the glory that's given to him. So it is with the church, to tell of Christ worthy of the glory that belongs to him. And all the time It's as though he is coming for her. That is what he has done. The glory that was his, he brings it and he wants to take a hold of a people for himself to share in that glory. I want you to take that away. Think on what it pictures for us of Christ's love for us. And then the beauty of the bride. And I turn to chapter 4. It is a longer chapter, but I'm going to deal with it a little more briefly. They are married. It's all poetry, and it's very short. It doesn't tell the whole story, but it tells us the key elements. And having been married, he now has the time, the opportunity, to praise the one whom he loves. In fact, in verses 9, 10, 11, and 12, and also in chapter 5, verse 1, he uses the word spouse. Tells us that they are married, husband and wife now. But as I draw attention to it, you might have noticed it as we read through when that word did appear several times, not every occasion, but several times he speaks of my sister, my spouse. And don't be uncomfortable with that. It's not an unsuitable thing. What it means there, I think, is it reflects the new permanence that she has in her relationship with him. After all, we often use it ourselves. My wife is now a daughter in my father's family. She is a sister to my sisters. And it reflects that level of things. She's brought into that family. She belongs now. And that's something that he enjoys, rejoices in as well. Now, of course, this chapter, I think, reflects the early days of their new marriage. Look at those wonderful words, the way that he just wants to talk about her and enjoy her. And it's not just physical, that is there in the first 5 verses, but it goes on beyond that as well. It's striking in verse 10 how he says, how fair, not is your hair or your face or your skin, but how fair is your love, what is coming out of her heart towards him. He appreciates that as well. What does that say to us about marriage? How should it be? Let us recognize the wisdom here, that there must be such appreciation and affirmation in marriage. Even in the physical. Don't be shy of it. Speak of it. Maybe you need to recognize it again and then speak of it. Not to be just used to the person you're with, but to go beyond that and to recognize and to affirm the love that is shared as well. How fair is your love? And then beyond that, I would put all of these things together. He talks about a garden. She is a garden and so on. I think that might be described as him seeing her as the one who would bring great riches that would open up in her life and there would be great riches for him to enjoy. So this chapter speaks of his great appreciation for his new bride. And he has a whole chapter to say it. He just pours it out. He exercises his poetic gifts. And he wants to tell her. She does nothing to stop him. She soaks it up. It does her good. There's not indifference. There's not awkwardness. There's no irritation. So often that does come about when you get used to one another. Are these things still appropriate? Yes, they are. And I think he knows that she needs this. But she allows him to pour out these effusions of praise concerning her. And they're not just words. They really are heartfelt. His love for her. And so the question, is this the approach in your marriage? Remember I'm saying the foundation of my questions is that marriage is crucial. It is the gift of God and must be exercised, must be used. Remember that uniqueness that I mentioned before in this marriage relationship? Are you building on that? A warning in the song into chapter 5. Very quickly, there's some, if you like, a wedge just appears between the two of them. Very quickly. Even with what you have in chapter 4. And if you don't have that, does it not give all the more opportunity for those things to come in to make division? If we fail to be active in our marriages, it's necessary in any relationship. Unless you're active, it starts to fade away. So it's necessary too in marriage. Not just for newlyweds. Let me do what Paul did in Ephesians chapter 5. He went from a human marriage to the marriage between Christ and his church, but he went the other way as well. And I'm reminded of what happens to the Ephesians, the very people he was writing to about Christ and the church. And in Revelation chapter 2, verse 4, Christ speaks to that Ephesian church and he says, "You have left your first love." Yes, they were still a church. They still spoke the name of Jesus. But the love wasn't there in their hearts. It wasn't active. It wasn't being exercised. We need to do the same, turning it the other way. If that applies between Christ and the church, it can happen too in marriage, to have left your first love. To all outward appearances, it's still complete. But how many other things have distracted? There may not even be another man or a woman involved in that from outside the marriage. But so many other things can be. Work. Children, as I've mentioned before. So on. And it's so important that we lay hold of exercising appreciation for each other within the marriage. The Ephesian church no longer exists. We cannot neglect heart love in our marriages, or it dies in all but form. And that is not a godly marriage. That's not the way he means it to be. And so my one last point, just to close on this, that here is as well the portrayal of the church in the sight of her Lord and husband. In this passage, he is the one who is overwhelmed with her beauty. And as I read the Bible, I am more and more amazed at Christ's view of the church, at God's view of his people through the Old Testament, at Christ's view of the church in the New. The church, it's only made up of weak little you, foolish little me, and yet he loves the church. This does indicate the joy that Jesus has in his people. And it does amaze me. Yet on the other hand, it shouldn't amaze me when I see what's happened here. When the woman hears this, or if she says the same thing, which she does in due course of him, there's no place for a false humility in a saying, "No, that's not me." And there's no place for a false humility in the church regarding Christ and his view of the church and its beauty as the bride that he desires. No place for false humility. Why? Yes, the church is beautiful. But it's made beautiful. It's his work. It's because of his love reaching out to the church. And so it shouldn't amaze us because of who he is. And I just urge you to bear these in mind. And to live out that beauty that he is pleased to bestow upon his church, that he is pleased to affirm in his church. Let us make his heart glad, the heart of our King. We would be a bride that is truly worthy of him. May God bless his word to us, each one this morning, to his praise.